In Ireland, nothing gets us talking like lions.
Tea?
Small talk.
Well, Jimmy, shocking weather we're having.
Big talk.
Even I could have played county. Office talk.
I'm MIA in the AM, but I'll circle back on the KPIs.
Real talk.
Milk before tea? Should be a criminal offence.
You could say we talk too much.
But the truth is,
we don't talk nearly enough. Lions puts the talk into tea.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan on News Talk.
Hello, and you're very welcome along to the Home Show podcast. This is News Talk's pod about homes, housing, interiors, and architecture. And I'm Sinead Ryan, the host. Coming up this week, well, our mini-series on the expert or not DIY skills of my News Talk colleagues continues, and this week it's a man who gets up very early in the morning, Shane Beattie. A building which will dwarf anything we've ever seen in Ireland is being constructed across the river from Houston Station. We'll be chatting to its architect, who definitely needs a head for heights. If you love flowers but hate them wilting, well, we've a permanent and very pretty solution. And Jennifer Sheehan is back from Milan with the quirky and very unusual interiors that could be coming to a showroom near you. If you'd like to get in touch with us on the Home Show podcast, you can email us at thehomeshow@newstalk.com, and you can find me on Instagram and on X. If you look for Sinead Ryan, and I do love to hear from podcast listeners there. And why don't you like and subscribe so you don't miss any episodes? Of course, they're all up on the Go Loud app. Now, our mini DIY series, not involving experts of any kind, but instead corralling our own News Talk presenters to get tips and hints, which shouldn't be relied on in any way, is proving fun. Last week, Anton Savage tried to kill himself several different ways. And this week, it's the turn of someone who gets up even earlier in the morning. Breakfast briefing presenter Shane Beattie. Hello.
Hello. How dare you say I'm not an expert in DIY? A proven expert in
it. It's our caveat, just in case anybody actually tries to follow suit.
Don't take any tips from me, please. Yeah.
Give us an initial rating out of 10, just so we can set the scene.
I would say I'm 4 out of 10, but my other half is an engineer, so he's better at it than me, so I'm just the skivvy.
Oh, yes. You see, you're the sous chef.
A skivvy and a bit of a supervisor as well, because I'll give my opinion, but no, definitely no expert in the area.
All right.
4 out of 10.
Yeah. Okay, 4 out of 10. I don't know, I think you're being modest, okay. But we'll see how we get on. Now, when it comes to what you can do and what you can't do, and what? Give us some of your wins. So what have you been able to do? Tell us a little bit about your house first.
Okay, so we live in a 4-bed semi-D in Naas, moved in November 2020, which actually was hard in itself because that was peak COVID time,
yes.
Which in some ways made it easier to decorate because you couldn't shop around. So you kind of just had to take what was available or what you could get being delivered. Like even the curtains, we had to just make a real quick decision about getting the curtains because we were about to go into another lockdown. So anyway, moved in November 2020, so nearly there 6 years. So it's a new build, which is good in one way, but then in another way, you have to do a lot of the work yourself because you have to put in things like your flooring and your tiling and stuff like that. In terms of wins, do you mean what jobs we've done then?
Yeah, what were you kind of satisfied that, look, I was able to do that myself.
Yeah.
I didn't have to, especially in COVID, because getting in people was doubly hard.
Yeah,
so
one of the big things we did was to, not so much DIY in the home, but in the garden, which we dug out a patio area. So we have a raised garden, so there's 3 steps up and then it's into grass, kind of not great soil, to be honest. So we dug out a big area to put in a patio.
Yourselves.
Now I'm classing that as a big win because I had to move myself 8-ton bags of soil from the back garden down a wheelbarrow with a makeshift sort of ramp, put it out the front into a ton bag for the waste company to come and collect that, which took forever to do.
It is heavy work, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So we did that. Then we laid the patio slabs down with a bit of your concrete, and also we built one of those fancy pergolas as well over it. That's my big win, I think.
Notions.
Yes, absolutely. Very fancy.
Great. Okay, well, that tells me that you're definitely up for the hard work.
Yeah.
And you're able, you know the sequence of events that you have to do. Because I think sometimes when people head into DIY themselves, they're like, I want to get to the nice paint bit.
I know. Yeah.
Don't have to do all the boring stuff.
And there are steps to it. So one of the other things we did was panelling. So you know this, that loads of people have panelling in their homes.
Love panelling.
It's lovely, but it costs a fortune to do. So we decided to do it ourselves. So we got the panels from Panel Shack, a company in Cavan, but you had to cut the panels into shape.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing which I didn't realise, and you're talking about stages here, I didn't realise how tough it was to do angles up a stairs.
You see, that's this is really why hard. We all did maths for the leavings. The parallelograms.
Yeah. Trigonometry, yeah.
I know. There was a reason for all that. I mean, you so wonder difficult. Why you learn things in school like Hamlet's soliloquy and Oxbow Lakes. But the maths is important.
It really is. I mean, the idea of getting panelling, and if anyone's giving it a go, I mean, it's definitely doable, but to get the angles right up a stairs is really, really tough.
It is.
And then you say getting to the paint job. What I didn't realise with panelling is you have to paint the wall with a different paint to the panels to make it all. So it's not just the same type of paint for the wooden panels versus the wall, which is really intricate to paint your wood and then paint the wall exactly the same but with a different type of paint.
Yeah, and you need the wall paint and the wood paint, even if it's the same colour.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's something to do with like eggshell and stuff like that, or there's a different type.
The different pigment.
Yes.
So, because it soaks into wood differently than it soaks into plaster. So did you do the clever thing and take all the panels out and do them first in the garden?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay.
That's a great idea. Why didn't I do that? So I painted it on the wall. That's a great idea to do.
Right.
Wow, you have to blow my mind.
For yourself there. Right, and, now, and you can so panel you everywhere
painted
else.
Painted the wall and then stuck the wooden panels up and then painted all of those
Lordy,
separately.
So you were into masking tape.
Yes.
And,
really, so that's a great idea.
Out the back garden, spray it all up.
Yeah. Right, another one as well, talking about angles. So we did our own flooring and we did herringbone flooring.
Wow.
For the sitting room and the hall.
That's big.
Yes, it is. But what I didn't realise with that, now I didn't do any of this, himself did, because I wouldn't have a clue, but you could spend a whole night getting the tiniest corner for your herringbone because you have to cut it so finely and specifically that for a because I would come down in the morning and go, is that all that was done overnight? Because it would take 3-4 hours.
Cue row.
Yeah, just for a tiny, tiny little corner to fit in against the wall.
Herringbone is top end DIY. So with that alone, I'm bringing up your 4 out of 10 or maybe your partner's whatever, up to like 9.
Yeah, I think so.
Herringbone is like putting together Jenga and a jigsaw.
It's so hard.
At the same time.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of people kind of cheat by putting beading around the corners, but we didn't want that because that's what everyone was doing. We wanted it to run
flush,
straight, flush into the wall.
But right.
It's so hard to get those angles.
Now, any kind of things you gave a go that didn't quite work out how you hoped?
Painting a wooden fence. I will never do this again in my life.
It soaks up the paint.
Disaster. Disaster. So you get your fence that comes with the house, right? And after a couple of years, you need to paint it. So I decided I'll take on painting a wooden fence. Now, I had dug out the patio.
What could go wrong?
We've painted rooms in our house. We've done coving. We've done all of that. Absolute disaster. It took, I would say, 4 coats. And I would say, so I finish work. I leave here around 10 in the morning, go home, have a nap. I would be out in the garden from 2 until about 8 every single day for about 3 weeks. To get this done. Horrific. I wouldn't do it in a heartbeat. And actually, I was looking last night because I knew I was talking to you this morning. They need to be done again because it's kind of been about 3 years.
Oh,
I certainly
you're triggered.
Won't be doing it.
You're triggered.
I will pay any money to get someone to paint my wooden fence because it was so hard.
Like, what do you, in retrospect, and you may not want to think about this now, maybe too upsetting, but did you use a primer? Like, where did you go wrong?
I'm not sure. I used one of the products that I think it actually said on it. One of those. I think it said on it that it was 1 coat, but it certainly wasn't. It was 3 or 4 coats.
Yeah.
And it just eat up the paint.
It does, because that burlap fencing, it just drinks it in.
I would never do that again.
Anything
ever.
You definitely wouldn't give a go?
I think anything electrical. I just think that you have to avoid that as well. Now, we had, just before Christmas, we had our pump started leaking and we can see some of the water coming up through the floorboards, a little bit, little bubbles of it. We tried to fix it ourselves and couldn't. Mm. And in hindsight, because what ended up happening was we had to get a plumber in on Christmas Eve to fix it for us. And I do think in hindsight, we should have just rang him straight away a couple of weeks before.
Okay.
So I think anything electrical, I certainly won't be doing the garden fence painting again. Wallpapering is hard. We did it in one bathroom. It's very, very difficult. And I think you should get an expert in to do that if you can.
Yeah.
Yeah. It looks easy, but it's not easy.
Yeah. Some of the wallpapers now that our designers, when they come in, recommend are the sticky back wallpapers rather than the paste and the table and trying to match up everything.
Matches. And again, there's your angles and cutting it finely.
Oh, you see.
Mats is playing a big factor here. Yeah.
What would you love to be able to do?
I think I would love to be able to do any sort of carpentry. I'm always amazed. I think it's like magic the way people, carpenters, can just knock together something and it just looks so well when it's constructed.
They probably did maths now.
They probably did, yeah.
There's a bit of that in it.
I also love as well, but I know it costs a fortune, I'd love to have a bookcase or some sort of display case with lights in it that I could do myself.
Like
I know
a bespoke kind of.
Beautiful.
Lovely.
I have loads that Mum and Dad gave me from their wedding 50, 60 years ago. They got, I can't remember the name of it, you know the blue and white willow pattern?
Yes.
They gave me a load of that from their
gorgeous
wedding.
Gorgeous.
And I would love, because a lot of our house is actually blue and white, like our couches are blue and white florally pattern. So I'd love that to match. But I'd also love to have lights on a display case for that.
Okay.
But I know to get that bespoke made would cost an absolute bomb.
It is. But you know what? It's one of those investment pieces that I think, you know, you'll have forever.
Yeah.
And it's perfect
and
for
the spot. And
it
might be worth a few quid as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah, right.
50, 60 years.
Yes. Joiners out there, any carpenters, give Shane Beattie a call and get him into all of that. Now, do you think that DIY skills, would you class that like with cooking and driving and swimming as a life skill? Should it be taught in schools?
100%.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I know woodwork was an option when I was in school, but I didn't do it.
Yeah.
But I think everyone should be doing it, absolutely. In the same way that boys and girls should be doing home ec, boys and girls. Like, even I'm thinking of my estate, there's loads of women who live by themselves who'd love to know some of these things.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, absolutely should be taught in schools, and also should be taught in schools because there's a big demand for getting a trade now.
There sure is.
We had a story in news recently that we only have 25 apprentice plasterers in the country.
Wow.
Now, can you imagine what they're going to be able to charge? Because it's such a unique skill. So right now, apprentice plasterers, we've only 25 of them.
Okay.
So like, they really should be encouraged to be taking up a trade because you're going to make a fortune.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so yes to the life skill, yes to teaching it in school. So then give us your final answer then. This is our final question we ask all our guests in this slot. Could you put together an IKEA Billy bookcase?
Now, I had to Google what that was, but I think I could. Yeah, I did put together a different bookcase from Easy Living.
Okay.
So I think I will be able to do it. Very good instructions, I think I will be
able
to do it.
They are. Yeah. But, and you wouldn't have bits left over.
Oh, I can't guarantee that. But I think they give you extra screws and stuff.
Do they? Just in
case.
It's only books going on, I'm sure. What could happen?
But listen, my advice to people is give it a go, because we got the calculator out at home and I reckon we saved €30,000.
Gosh.
By doing these jobs ourselves.
Gosh.
I really do. Even the patio alone, I think we saved about 10 grand.
What should everybody be able to do at home?
I think everyone should be able to change a light bulb. Can I give you an example recently? In our estate WhatsApp group, people are asking for electrician numbers to change light bulbs.
No.
It's ridiculous.
No.
I think everyone should be able to mow their lawn. You know, I think you should be able to paint a room. I'm not talking very high ceilings, but I think you should be able to paint a room at least and understand how to do
that. Okay, fairly straightforward. All right, we get our top tips then from Shane.
Don't take any advice.
Thanks a million for joining us on the Home Show with that. And we'll have another presenter up next week. Well done. You're doing very well now.
Thank you.
You're topping the leaderboard there. So you're
talk a good talk.
Shane Beattie, thanks a million.
The Home Show on News Talk. The Home Show on News Talk.
Now, Dublin isn't known for skyscrapers the way London or New York is, yet we may be about to get our first. Located near Euston Station, the Parkgate development will reach 30 stories or 102 metres high. Now, to put that in context, it's almost double the height of Liberty Hall. Joining me now to talk us through this feat of construction is its architect, Tony Reddy of Reddy Architecture and Urbanism. And on the line is Seamus Guidera, Chair of the Royal Institute of Architects in Ireland. Gentlemen, you're both very welcome to the show. Tony, where do you begin with a project of this size?
Well, I think the first thing just to say about this is that unlike most sites in the country, this is one site where the local authority from an early stage had determined that this was an appropriate place for a building of significance. And that meant that it was likely to be a tower. So a lot of time was most of the other taller buildings in the city have tended to be confrontational with the city. So the focus for Dublin City Council, for our client, Castlethorne Developments, Joe O'Reilly, and ourselves, was to ensure that it was an appropriate response to the zoning. In other words, that it was a building of significance when it's finished.
So you were actively asked to build something very different and kind of brave.
Yes, it was. And it led in the early stages. It was very interesting because there hadn't been towers here. The planning process took quite a while. We got planning permission for the rest of the development. And it should be said, there's a lot of other things about this development that are important. Like, and this is based on international best practice. There's a major public, there are two courts and one for residents, but there's another one which is a public space. It will face south onto the river, which doesn't exist now. Right now, the site is completely closed off to the public. I think people will be quite amazed. Besides the tower, the public realm at ground level is a very significant addition to the city.
So there'll be amenities and green and open space and
correct.
All of that.
And it's south-facing, which is a huge
lovely.
Advantage.
Now, what is the mix between housing units and retail or office space, or what's the balance there?
Okay, well, it would be fair to say it's predominantly a residential scheme. At ground level, there are other activities, but yeah. as a proportion of the overall, it's relatively small. But it's still way more than is there at present. Right now, it's a warehouse, and it's really quite a neutral effect on the surrounds.
Well, one thing that won't be a problem is transport. It is right up against Houston Station,
it's right across the river from
right kind of like adjacent to it.
Yes.
And you have that juxtaposition, which I think must be a very difficult thing to do. You have a very old Edwardian building sitting there with all its beautiful arches and a stone, and it's kind of iconic because everybody knows what it looks like. And then on one side you have the brand new shiny Lewis, and your building then is going to really tower up into the sky. Is it always a worry that you just get that, the aesthetic on that, just right?
Well, I think that's what I referred to earlier, that the concern we had, as the city had, was to get the proportions of the building right, to get verticality. And that there was quite a lot of debate about that. To make it viable, one needed a certain scale of a plan. Mm. In other words, a certain number of residential units. But when you begin to then explore that, it can look very stump-like. So that's what has led to the very tall form. The other factor, which is really interesting, is there are view corridors in the city plan that have to be protected.
Oh,
one of them is of the Wellington Monument, particularly as you come up the quays. So the positioning of the building on the site, we had lots of debates. It took us a long time to decide where on the site to put the tower. But where it's located, it has no impact on the Wellington Monument.
So that sight line,
as you come up,
you have
the keys.
To be able to see it.
Yeah.
Okay. And Camir, is there anything, I'm thinking in my very un-architect's head about building a Jenga tower four times bigger than Jenga is there any extra worry or extra concerns about, does the height itself bring different challenges
between
50 metres and 100 metres?
It does. And in fact, we brought a very good colleague of mine, Grant Howells, who has done a lot of towers internationally and is a good friend of mine. He was very important. When we had our planning permission, it was a key point. So he advised very closely on his experience. Mm. And I think that was a big help because it gave... This is probably more at the level of buildability and practicality, et cetera. He gave a lot of confidence to... well, firstly to our own team, but also to the Castlethorne theme about... and indeed the John Paul Construction.
That was going to work.
Well, not so much that it would work, but that sometimes the costs can go off the Richter scale. Having done it before, he knew international suppliers that were experienced in the field.
Oh, here now, we won't be mentioning other projects that we had international experts on and they were still waiting on them to be built and the billions are stacking up. All right. Well, listen, that's about that building. Now, the work is starting this year. It's going to take how long?
It'll be 29 before it's finished.
2029. Yeah. Okay. So everybody in Dublin is going to see that going up. It's going to be an iconic site for a long time, and it's going to be quite spectacular, exciting.
In the early years, because the tower is the first piece to be built.
Yeah.
And it'll go up quite quickly.
Will it? Mm. Okay, very good. Well, let me turn now to Seamus Cordero, who's been waiting patiently on the line there, Chair of the Royal Institute of Architects. Seamus, should we be doing more of this stuff? I mean, every other city manages it.
I think absolutely. Like, really what we're talking about here is density. And we need good density within our cities. And height is a very effective way to achieve that. And as Tony rightly said, this site is perfect for height. Mm. You know, it's been zoned that way in the latest Dublin City Development Plan. It's on a transport node. And there's also very interesting precedents from other cities where height isn't always most appropriate at the city centre. A lot of the time, these transport nodes just outside the city centre are best placed to provide it. And really what we want to promote, and is evident in this scheme, is that good design and good planning is so important at an early stage, because it's not just numbers that we're looking at. We know we need more homes. We know we need more people living in the city, but we want to do it right. And we want to plan it right and make sure that density is appropriate.
Where else would you see that there's scope for that? Because you're right, people don't want a big kind of structure towering over their semi-detached housing estate. But would places like the Docklands, or even maybe up as far as Drogheda or down to Rosslare or Cork, would they be areas where you could actually build a conurbation of height and density?
Absolutely. Look, we have another tower in Cork that's just topped out, and I think that might briefly be Ireland's tallest residential building until Park 8 is constructed. And there are other parts of the city that have been earmarked for height. So the Docklands, the Tower Street corridor. Mm. There's lots of opportunity. I think, to touch on a point earlier, I think what's key here is viability. And by that, I mean costs.
Yeah.
And the more we go up, the more it costs, because we're not just adding things like additional firefighting shafts, additional structure. We also tend to have a smaller floor plate. So that slenderness ratio, where we don't want a big looming tower at a very high level, that makes those floor plates less efficient for a developer or for a builder. So it can be a challenge to balance the viability of the scheme with wanting to go higher on a site. So there's lots of examples of developers or landowners that have chosen not to build very tall planning applications that have been granted in the city.
Yeah, and we've heard previously from architects on the Home Show that they're saying, look, you know, you can build something four stories, but the extra four stories is more than the same cost again, because there's a lot of dead space in terms of lift shafts and, you know, corridors and things that you can't sell. So
exactly,
that has to be taken into it. Do you think, you welcome this development now, and as Tony said, with the council suddenly saying, yes, go be brave, go do these things. Are you hopeful that there could be more of this in the future, Seamus?
Absolutely. And I think what we need is good precedents. And this is a good precedent. And a lot of the time, the challenges that we face with planning and with regulatory bodies is finding a good precedent in Dublin or in Ireland where it has been done successfully. And that's both for the local authority, but also, as Tony said, for clients. You know, it takes a client's putting their neck on the line saying, let's do this. And they've done the maths and it works for them. So I think there's a lot of positives that will come from this, and hopefully others will use it as a means to also go higher in the city. But as I said, it's not the only means to densify different parts of the city. There's lots of very good mid-rise examples, living over the shop and the like. But this is, you know, a very site-specific, successful way of achieving density, I think, beside Houston Station.
Okay, let me go back to Tony briefly, because you very nearly had already done this. You were going to be building the U2 tower.
We were one of the entrants for the competition for the U2 tower, but Norman Foster actually won it.
That was going to be really tall.
It was going to be really tall, taller than this.
Yeah.
But there is one general point, and I think Seamus touched on it there. These tall buildings are really a part of a bigger plan. The city of the future city of Ireland should be using the European norm of maybe 6-7 stories.
Yeah.
That will get our general density. the purpose of these taller buildings is like the modern version of the church spire.
Yeah.
It's to create a focal point on the skyline that allow people to actually read their city in the distance.
Yeah. And imagine what it could look like if it wasn't just one of these, but you bring up the whole skyline, you know, to a different
level. And in answer to your question, I personally think that that's probably an exercise. DCC have done it a little bit, but there's probably a case, as you say, at a number of other nodes to actually define them on the skyline. As our city expands, they'll become very important.
And we end up with our walkie-talkie and our gherkin and these iconic buildings that people maybe don't like at the beginning.
Not the walkie-talkie.
Okay. You don't like that one.
It's not that I don't like it. It's the one where it famously torched a car on the street. It's like a child with a magnifying glass. That was the effect.
Yeah. Okay, all right. Okay, well, we'll try and avoid that in your building then, Park 8. We might, if we're still around in 2029, we'll go out and take a look at it and we'll go up in the lift. It'll be a bit of fun, if nothing else, just to be up that high and get fantastic views. Yes. All right. Well, my thanks on the phone to Seamus Godera, Chair of the RIAI Architecture and Public Affairs Committee, and Tony Reddy, Reddy Architecture. And the very best of luck with that building. Can't wait to see it.
Thank you very much.
Now, we all love to receive flowers, but it's always a shame when they wilt just a few days later. Well, one artist has solved the problem by creating bespoke and very beautiful flowers made from paper, and you won't be able to tell them from the real thing. Beam Irwin of Blooms by Beam, welcome to the Home Show.
Hello, thank you for welcoming me here. I'm very excited to be here.
Now, I came across your work on Instagram and it seems appropriate as it is really lovely artwork and it's very Instagrammable. How did you get started?
Oh, Sinead, it actually started during COVID. I just immigrated to this country during the start of COVID, and I was in the usual two-week isolation just after you go to a flight. And I was bored out of my wits in the spare room that we have. And I was looking outside in the garden, in our garden, and I was seeing all the flowers blooming. And I felt so isolated because I'm just inside and I couldn't enjoy them. And at that time, the only thing I was surrounded with in that spare room were paper bags, receipts, old newspaper. And I turned them into paper flowers with just basic scissors and glue that I had back then.
Very interesting. Now, you had come from where? The Philippines?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And this seems to me, I mean, these are sculptures. There's no other word for it. But it seems like nearly there's a touch of origami about it. It's about how you are using the paper. And then you're adding in these beautiful colour and paint structures. What's involved in creating one of these flower masterpieces?
So I wish that I could say that it has something to do directly with a Philippine heritage craft. But I think with a Philippine heritage craft, it's just all about detailing and it's all about embroidery there and capiz shells turned into flowers. And I think that it kind of stemmed from the intricacy of Philippine crafts. With the paper as well, I use Italian crepe paper. Mm-hmm. I found that, and again, I started from receipts and paper bags, and I had to kind of really experiment on different kinds of paper and what would hold its shape and with the kind of manipulation that I do with it. And I realized that Italian crepe paper is really, is very robust. It's very structural. And then I could form it and manipulate it into this. I love that you mentioned Ikebana style and origami style, because I'm actually inspired by the Japanese flower arrangement as well. And it's very just sculptural and things hanging on air, and you can't figure out how does it hang on air like that. It looks so delicate. But really, it's the Italian crepe paper, the quality of it and the robust quality of it that really holds its shape.
Yes, indeed. And it is very difficult. It must be very, very difficult to get this to do that, because paper of itself, it's flimsy, you know, it doesn't kind of lend itself to something sculptural. But you said there you use Italian crepe paper. What other materials are you using? And if anybody wants to look at this Beam site while we are talking about it, just give me your Instagram handle, Beam, for this.
So it's instagram.com/bloomsbybeam.
Okay. And people can see it. So talk to me then about the different textures that you are using here.
So with the materials that I use, it's actually available in a craft kit that I also sell in my website. And they're beginner friendly because a lot of people are very interested with this paper flowers, you know, that I make, and they want to have a little knack themselves with these paper flowers. So I made some very beginner-friendly craft kits.
Okay. People can give it a go. Now, we should probably warn any would-be sculptors out there that, you know, this takes an awful lot of work and an awful lot of time. It is almost impossible to tell that these are not real flowers until you touch them, I expect. And these pieces, that, I mean, look, they are expensive. There's no doubt about it. It's what you would pay for a piece of art rather than a bunch of flowers. But they do last a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do. In fact, one trick that I do is I give them a coat of UV protective spray just to protect the intensity, the vibrancy of the colors. I do still say to people who buy the paper flowers and paper plants to keep it away from direct sunlight to avoid it from fading.
Now, is every piece bespoke, or can people shop on your website? I mean, each one of these is handmade, I presume?
Yes, so each one is kind of made to order. I do have the elements of it in place. So, for example, if one person orders one of the best sellers, the geraniums, the paper geraniums, I already have the leaves in place and the petals in place. So all I have to do really is kind of assemble them and permanently plant them in the vintage English terracotta pots that planted in.
Now, like the attention to detail is extraordinary. So talk to me a little bit about the painting element, the colour element of these pieces.
So some of these flowers, for example, the crocuses that I made, the petals of it, I wanted it to be very impressionistic in style. So what I actually did was, instead of just putting watercolor on it, I actually drowned the whole roll of crepe paper in watercolor to achieve this kind of impressionistic, kind of brushy, dreamy effect. And the water just does it. If you imagine you drown or you put paper on water, and it kind of fades it a little bit, but not too much. So that's what happened, actually. So sometimes people would ask me, Beam, your plants are so realistic, I'm worried that I might accidentally water it. And I'd say to them, actually, you can, because I actually drowned these in watercolor, and it still ends up fine.
And it ends up fine, and it doesn't dissolve in the water when you do it. How long does it take you to make one of these structures, these sculptures, Beam?
So I'd always say I'd probably watch a few episodes of Broadchurch or something.
There's nothing like a crime drama to get you in the mood for paper flowers.
Yes. And if it's David Tennant, I'm all for it.
Right.
So probably around 5 episodes of a David Tennant show.
Right. There we go. Now we know what makes this work. This is why this works. Okay. It must be very tiring work. Is it very tiring? Like, is it tiring on the fingers and on the eyes?
You know what? I really try to kind of be gentle with myself with this. What I do is, if I do feel tired, I really tend to do something else. Because I want to enjoy this, and I am enjoying this work. I feel like it's a luxury that I can say to myself and to people that this is what I do, and I really love it. So I make sure that I keep it balanced. I don't overwork my hands, because this is my tool.
Yeah.
So I really kind of swap my activities every day so I don't tire myself out.
All right. Well, listen, they are absolutely lovely, and continued success. That's Blooms by Beam, B-E-A-M. And you will find that on Instagram, and you can see what is going on there. Beam Irwin, thank you so much for joining us on The Home Show today. Coming up after the break, Jenny Sheehan will be in. She's just back from Milan at this very odd kind of interiors design festival that goes on there. And she's been bringing us some of the wackiest designs that are coming to a store near you soon. And we'll see you after the break.
The Home Show on News Talk. The Home Show on News Talk.
Hello, welcome back to The Home Show here on News Talk. I'm Sinead Ryan with you till the top of the hour. If you want to get in touch with us, it is thehomeshow@newstalk.com. 53106 if you want to get in touch by text. There's me tripping over my words. Now, in the designer's chair this week is show favourite Jennifer Sheehan, former Home of the Year winner. It's hard to pin her down these days. You've been travelling.
I can't stay still. I just can't sit in one place for too long. I've been in Italy. Italy every April, just Milan in particular, just goes bananas for design. And it's an incredible experience. Now, it's an expensive one, so it was a short trip. But every year we have Salone del Mobile, which is a, you know, room of furniture, the furniture showcase. And there's a number of similar shows on around, you know, there's a big one in Paris twice a year. There's one in London. There's a few around, and they're usually trade only. But Salone is different because it opens to the public at the weekend. So that's interesting. It's good to go and see, you know, what's out there. But more interestingly is across the entire city of Milan is this Fuori Salone, which is like a fringe design festival. So everything from, you know, a local Potter to IKEA to Gucci to everyone who's involved in any way in interiors and design has some kind of a showcase or an installation or an exhibition. And it's wild because they're all vying for attention. So kind of similar to, you know, what you might see on the runways where people have very attention grabbing. You know, there was these kind of toes only flip flops on this
right,
year. It wasn't for me.
Okay.
But same with furniture design. So it's, you know, it's wilder and wilder every year.
Okay, well, before we get on to the weird and wonderful, which of course we love on The Home Show, a little bit oddball, tell us about some of the serious trends that may be coming our way now in the next year or two. Because it's a bit like a fashion show. You see the weird costume on stage, but actually a version of it, like the cerulean blue, if anybody's gone back to work, that makes its way into High Street.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's loads. I think I always say this, and I've been saying it for a few years, but it's getting further and further, is lighting. So we are really pushing the boundaries, when I say we, not me personally, when it comes to lighting and things like, you know, being able to redesign your home without completely tearing up everything. They're making huge headway in that. So, and I think we need this in Ireland. We have a couple of lovely lighting design shops, but we need more. And it's something we've been a little bit behind on. So I love to see it. And it's, you know, it was on show everywhere. There was a lot of new kitchen trends this year. So I haven't seen too many in the past few years, but one trend I love is this combination hob, where you have an induction hob, a bit of a spider burner, a plancha, all in kind of one device. So it looks really clean and neat together and has a downdraft extractor fan with it. So that
we
was
like
on
a
show.
Downdraft extractor on The Home Show. We definitely do, because it gets rid of the hood.
It gets rid of the hood, and I never want a hood. I don't like anything overhead.
It's like a sucky device that brings all the smoke. It's fantastic, actually.
It's great. Yeah, it is great. Yeah.
Okay, so more of that. Some of the other stuff that you found, you brought me in here because I'm looking at these pictures here. Because see, she knew I wouldn't actually believe her description, so she's included pictures for me here. A giant cat playground. Now, this looks like I'll tell you what this looks like. One of those giant Lego pieces, or, you know, a Meccano pieces that you make out of a kit. But it looks as if it's about like 6 feet high.
I mean, does giant do this justice? This is, you know, this...
Is this, sorry,
you need
is
a room
this actually
for cats?
It's for
cats. It's for cats. So this is, holy if God. Anybody wants to look this up, it's called Domus Felis. The designer is Andrea Manzoli. And it has been described as a visual narrative between myth and mystery where the cat emerges as an enigmatic and archaic presence. And I have to say, looking at this sculpture, it's not a bad description. I don't know what else I would call it.
The cat in the garden, in a box.
It's an almost gothic, isn't it?
It you is.
Know, very
it looks
intricate
like, yeah,
playground.
Actually, I'm looking at it here, and because you were in Italy, mm-hmm. it looks a bit like the town of Matera, which is down south, mm-hmm. you know, and people remember from one of the James Bond films where Daniel Craig went roaring around on a motorcycle in this ancient, ancient city where they built houses on top of each other because it was a cliff and they'd no choice. So that looks like
a lucky cat.
A lucky cat. Okay. Now, the next thing you have, this fascinates me because I love a quokka tap.
Do you?
I do not have a quokka tap because my other half won't have one. Partly because it costs about £1,000. So quokka is one of these taps. We have one outside here. Well, it's a version of it in News Talk in the coffee station. And it has boiling water and cold water. Mm. And then the quokka one probably has fizzy water as mm-hmm. well. So you just touch a button and you don't need to be faffing about. This, you came across a chef who's using it for an entirely different purpose.
And this is what I mean by vying for attention. So quokka, yes, in instant boiling water, which sounds great. But this chef was using the tap to cook fish. So he had almost, I would assume, sushi grade fish, you know, sliced quite thinly in little chunks and decorated really. And he would just take a little pair of chopsticks and he would hold the little piece of fish under the running boiling water from the quokka tap for a few seconds and out would come and the fish would be cooked sufficiently.
Right. Okay. Jamie Oliver, on one of his very early programs, used to wrap a salmon in tin foil and stick it in the dishwasher. So this isn't
new. In the
new.
Dishwasher?
Yeah, yeah. Cook it in the dishwasher.
Okay.
It's heat. Steam.
Yeah, but I mean, there's many ways to get heat.
Yeah. Right. You're obsessed with the loo.
Love it.
You love a toilet.
I
what
love
more
the
can
loo.
Happen? The
I
toilet.
Love the loo. This I couldn't get enough of this. So this is by a French company called Trone, T-R-O-N-E, which sounds like throne, which I really appreciate. And the toilet is called the Icone, I-C-O-N-E. So I do recommend looking this up. And it has a see-through cistern. So
why?
This is
why? Why would you want so a see-through fun. Cistern? Any more than you'd want a see-through seat?
So there's a big, you know, tube coming up the back of this toilet that's filled with water, and there's this elegant little button on top, and when you are finished you press this button and you can see the water emptying out of the tube cistern and then refilling, and it's experiential.
Okay, I leave my why sitting out there. Now
I wish I'd taken a photo.
It gets better, please. Folks, gets better. The Ozempic chair.
The Ozempic chair. Now, it's not actually called the Ozempic chair. It has been nicknamed the Ozempic chair broadly by the design community. I saw on El Decor. It's called the Metric Chair. It's designed by Michael Anastasiades for B&B Italia. The nickname is because it is impossibly thin. And I could
skinny chair.
Say it's a skinny chair. And I could say this is another trend because there has been a real slimming down of furniture.
Right.
In the design world, they're calling visual dieting. It's not quite minimalism, but I guess it is an exploration of how thin can you get and how visually slim can
and,
you get
and maintain structure. So this is just like an architectural engineering kind of, you know, let's see how far we can go before somebody falls through it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, how visually... kind of so that it looks as if it's not going to hold your weight.
Yeah. And the argument here is that has been influenced by the fashion world. And it's not right. the only chair. You know, there were others that were incredibly slim that looked like if you sat on it, it might collapse, but they're very strong.
Okay. Okay. So. Right. Now, if a foosball table is your thing, and why wouldn't it be? Why wouldn't it be? We watched all those episodes of Friends, mm-hmm. Joey and Chandler's apartment. You came across a designer version of this.
Yes. So Louis Vuitton has what I must describe as beautiful. They have a new collection called Objet Nomads, which is, you know, water under the sea, mermaids, whatever it might be. And this is their mermaid foosball table. And it is made from beautiful, shimmery materials, there's leather there, and all of the little players are mermaids, and it's quite pretty.
It is actually very beautiful. I have to say, it's very beautiful. It's very weird. Yeah. If you walked into somebody's living room and found that there, you would see nothing else in the house. Any idea what price this thing is?
Oh, we're looking, I mean, tens of thousands.
If you have
it's
to ask, you can't afford it. All right. Okay, up in that category. Okay. Mm-hmm. And while we're on the structural stuff, actually, do you know what? Let me go to the one that actually...
I knew you were going to love this
one. Idea why this exists. But you have a very tiny house, so maybe this works for you.
Yeah.
It is an oven, wait for it, an oven with a built-in dishwasher.
But do you not think that this is genius? I think this is genius. So this is AEG, the German brand AEG. They have this oven. Now, my oven is self-cleaning, so it's the pyrolytic function where it goes on fire and you wipe away the ash, and that's great. But you have to take all of the trays and the side racks and everything out of it. And by the time you've done that, you may as well just clean the oven itself. Mm. So this is the next step where the oven is plumbed, it's built in, you leave everything in it, you run the dishwasher, and then you have a sparkling clean oven. I mean, it just doesn't sell itself. No, how are you not sold on this? I think this is absolutely genius.
Okay, all right. Okay, we'll take it. We'll take it. We also had, which we don't have time to discuss, sadly, not really sadly, a giant inflatable octopus and a lobster by Moncler, who already makes overpriced everything, and a table lamp in the shape of a Bic pen. Mm-hmm. Jenny, as always, you continue to dazzle and amaze us on the Home Show. There is no end to the weird and wonderful out there in home furnishings, folks. And listen, this is coming. You might just see a version of this next year in a regular store that you might be passing. So you'll know where it came from and you'll know where you heard it first. And that is the Home Show. Jenny Sheehan, thank you very much. At Workers Cottage is Jenny's Instagram, and you can find all of the this stuff and the normal, the regular stuff is up there as well. All right. And that's all we have time for this week on the Home Show podcast. If you've enjoyed it, why not hit like and subscribe so you don't miss any episodes? And if you know somebody who might be interested in listening, well, why don't you tell them? Pass on the good news that there is a show about homes and interiors and architecture. And we would love to have all of those listeners. My thanks to producer Aoife Breen. Stephen McLoone was on sound. And we will be back here next week with another episode.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan. Saturday at 5 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.